Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Striking news this week, a Chrysler walkout come and gone, a sudden U.S. standoff with Turkey, another school shooting in Cleveland, and in Oslo, Al Gore takes the Nobel Peace Prize for his inconvenient truths about climate change. The Peace Prize Committee called him a green hero.
He is probably the single individual who has done most to create greater worldwide understanding of the measures that need to be adopted.
Fred Thompson came on easy at his first Republican debate.
I've enjoyed watching these fellas. I gotta admit, it was getting a little boring without me, but I'm glad to be here now.
And House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said it was right to label the killings of Armenians in 1915 as genocide, despite 2007 blowback from Turkey and pushback from President Bush.
There's never a good time. And all of us in the Democratic leadership have supported, reiterating Americans' acknowledgement of a genocide.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable goes behind the week's headlines. You can join the conversation. What do you say to Al Gore, to Fred Thompson and the Republican field, to Nancy Pelosi on Turks and Armenians and more? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Great gang with us today. Joining me now from Washington is Clarence Page, Pulitzer Prize-winning, nationally syndicated columnist for the Chicago Tribune. Clarence, great to have you. Welcome back.
Thank you, Tom. Good to be here.
Joining us from New York is Stephen Spruill, staff writer for the National Review and its website. Stephen, a big welcome back to you as well. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Tom.
And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point News analyst Jack Beattie, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Jack, great to have you.
Hello, Tom, Clarence, and Steve.
Hi, Jack.
Okay, here we've got Al Gore all over the news right in front of us. Hat trick, an Oscar, an Emmy, now the Nobel Prize. Clarence Page, what do you say to Al Gore this morning?
He's going to Disney World.
He's going there, and what's he? What's he taking with him? I mean, what does it mean about the world? What the world thinks about America? Thinks about Al Gore? Thinks about
global warming? I just wanted to say something different from everybody else, because everybody's saying, "Well, he's got to run for president now," as if that is automatically your ticket punch to go run for president.
Right.
That's what everybody's talking about. And no, I don't think that's going to happen, because the Democratic field is so strong right now. He would be viewed as a disruptor. Force by everybody who didn't love him. So why divide your own party? If the Democratic field was as soft in its support as the Republican support is right now for their candidates at present, I'd be very tempted if I were Al Gore to go and jump in there, because I think Republicans are looking for a strong candidate more than the Democrats are at this point.
Jack Beattie, it is kind of just a remarkable turn of events from that very, very bitter low point in 2000 to Al Gore's comeback and now the Nobel Peace Prize, along with the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. I mean, what do you read in this, Jack? Is this really about American presidential politics, or is it about something else, something bigger? How do you describe it?
Well, to me, the Academy put it best when it said he is probably the single individual who did the mm-hmm. most to make this. And this reminds us of what individuals can do in history. You know, later this week you're going to have, or next week you're going to have a new translation of War and Peace, the translator on the program.
Next week,
and,
yeah.
And in his epilogue to War and Peace, Tolstoy famously wrote that kings are the slaves of history, that history, in fact, drives individual wills, and that it's a vast impersonal process in which, you know, the decisions of leaders, of individuals, cannot play any role. Well, of course, we know now that if the 2000 election had gone the other way, we would not have this war in Iraq. That is simply clear. This war was willed by one man. Of course, he was aided and abetted by lots of other people. But this reminds us, I think, of, you know, the difference individual decision can make for the destiny of nations. And here we have Al Gore. You know, his individual effort has done as much to bring this terrible planetary challenge to public consciousness as anything.
Stephen Spruill, I want to get you on this, but let's listen for just a second to Al Gore. I haven't heard tape of him yet today. I'm sure he will speak. But here he was in May speaking on NPR about global warming.
Look, I am trying to play a constructive role
in rallying people to solve the climate crisis. And in pursuing this task, I have come to feel ever more strongly that in order to solve the climate crisis, we're going to have to address these deep problems in the way we make decisions.
Stephen Spruill, Al Gore, heroic individual driving history?
Well, I don't know about that. I think that giving him this prize is such a stretch. You know, I mean, what does it have to do with peace? I know that the committee cited the probability of climate change leading to war and global conflict. I don't
see
it.
Do you doubt that possibility?
Do we really live in such a peaceful world that that this is the ultimate concern of the Nobel Peace Prize Committee? I don't get it.
I mean, water shortage, food shortage. People talk about all kinds of calamity potentially falling out of global warming. You don't see that as a potential path to more conflict or steering away as potentially a path toward peace?
I think it's very much a stretch. You know, we don't have those. We know that the planet is warming, and we know that we're contributing to it. But those dire, calamitous predictions, there's still wide disagreement on whether or not any of that would come about. And moreover, I think that we have more urgent problems and more deserving people. For instance, and I know this sounds kind of crazy, but what about the Sunni sheikhs in Iraq who have turned against al-Qaeda, who have united with our troops there to try to pacify that country? I mean, to me, there's no more destructive force to peace in this world right now than al-Qaeda and global jihad, and the fact that you have such an inspiring movement in Anbar. I think for instance, that could have been recognized.
So maybe you'd put Iraqi sheikhs from Anbar up on the podium at Oslo.
I would do that before I would put Al Gore up there, I'll tell you that.
Clarence Page, never mind whether he will run or not, but how do you imagine, I mean, none of us are inside Al Gore's mind, but we've all watched him for a long, long time here. How do you imagine he's looking out at the world now? I mean, he's got a lot of the ultimate accolades under his belt here, but not the ultimate office. Do you see him as a long-term, what kind of oracle role here to the country, to the world? What is the Al Gore role here now?
Well, I'd be looking at myself with a lot of satisfaction right now if I were Al Gore. I think he has moved the debate. Steve just said, we know now that global warming is happening. We know that humans are contributing to it. We didn't know that a few years ago. I mean, it was hotly debated. There was a lot more resistance from especially the conservative pro-industrialist side, if you will. Mm. The Bush administration has moved very much so in the direction of research that shows humans do have an impact. And now we're talking more about what can we do about it. Gore has moved the debate. The Nobel Committee historically tries to make a statement. They try to move debates. They try to come out in favor of those who are political prisoners somewhere or to boost the cause of peace. Maybe next year they will do something to honor the Iraq sheikhs if indeed they are starting to make some more progress. But, I think that this is an appropriate award right now as far as Gore is concerned. I'm sure he's looking ahead to the future for a possible presidential run. I don't think he's going to do it this time.
We'll talk more about Al Gore, I'm sure, but let's turn to another front. Lots of conversation in Congress this week, 2007, about something that happened in 1915, the killing of Armenians, genocide in Turkey. The House committee there voting to put that label on it again, just when Turkey is being quite helpful to the U.S. in difficult circumstances in the region. Secretary of Defense Robert Gates warned on Wednesday that a vote in Congress to label the killing of Armenians during World War I genocide could prompt Turkey to stop serving as a supply route for U.S. forces in Iraq.
They believe clearly that access to airfields and to the roads and so on in Turkey would be very much put at risk if this resolution passes and the Turks react as strongly as we believe they will.
We heard Nancy Pelosi saying no time is a bad time to call genocide for what it is, but here's Representative Dan Burton, Republican of Indiana, saying it sends the wrong signal now.
We're in the middle of two wars, and we've got troops out there over there that are at risk. And we're talking about kicking the one ally that's helping us over there in the face right now. It just doesn't make any sense to me.
Stephen Spruill, what do you make of this committee vote? Not to the full floor yet, but it may well come there. Where are we headed?
Well, I think it's kind of interesting. You know, Nancy Pelosi said there's never a good time to address these issues, but sometimes are worse than others. And I think that right now we have an instance where it's kind of ironic. The Democrats are always chiding Bush for not giving diplomacy enough of a chance, and here he's trying to be diplomatic, and they're you know, very dramatically undercutting him.
Jack Beatty, no time, a bad time, no good time, no bad time. Let's just call it for what it is. Can the U.S. afford that position right now?
Well, it's complicated now, but when the Turkish government says, and I quote, "It is unacceptable that the Turkish nation has been accused of something that never happened in history." Well, the inconvenient truth is that it did happen, and Turkish national identity is based on a lie, and the modern state. And,
the whole thing? That's a pretty – what do you mean there, Jeff?
Well, the denial that this happened. And it's people are killed, editors are killed in Turkey if they publicize this. This is a and they want the whole rest of the world to go along with them and to agree that this didn't happen or to kind of pretend it didn't. Well, you know, in fact, the future with the globally warming future makes genocide a more and more a frightening prospect. We saw something like that in Rwanda, where it was a competition over limited land that helped to drive that frightful mess. In Darfur, again, it's a competition over meager and vanishing resources. So this is we need historical memory to remind us these terrible things can happen.
But if you're a U.S. trooper in a foxhole in Iraq, Jack, what about the timing?
Well, you know, this is another reason why we shouldn't have gone into Iraq, isn't it? Many of us said that at the time.
We've got a lot more to look at here. Sorry, Jack. Please stand by. And Stephen Spruill, Clarence Page, listeners, we're looking at a week in the news. Join us. 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. Al Gore wins a Nobel. Tensions with Turkey. Another school shooting. Fred Thompson takes the stage. Dow's back at an all-time high. Inequality growing as well. You can join the conversation. What do you think? What's your top story out of all that welter this week? What do you make of Al Gore with a Nobel Peace Prize? Should he keep giving his slideshow or run for president? And what about Turkey? Are we making an enemy of a rare ally there, or is that the price moral rectitude requires on Armenian history, on genocide? Did you see Fred Thompson's debate debut? Were you impressed? We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Clarence Page joins us, nationally syndicated columnist for the Chicago Tribune. Stephen Spruill is here, staff writer for the National Review and National Review Online. Jack Beatty's here as well. Right now, Bob's calling from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Bob, you're on the air.
Yes, hi.
Hi, what do you know?
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay, 2 points. I'll go on the Nobel Peace Prize. There's an well-deserved honor. He is an eloquent spokesman, and it sounds like he's a Republican Al Gore hater on there today.
Well, Bob, I just about could make that out, but you're heading off into the ozone with us. It sounds like a thumbs up for Al Gore, and we'll take that. Let's get one more call here from Augusta, Georgia. Adamore is on the line. Hi, Adamore. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you today? Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. What do you know?
My name is Atanor Kaloskan. I would like to ask Nancy Pelosi the question, and how is this the way United States appreciation to Turkey? The Turkey has been helping the United States in the Korea, Somalia, Kosovo, Afghanistan, and Iraq. I'm kind of surprised on this the Congress decision. What they did vote for.
Adamore, let me just ask you, are you Turkish? Are you Turkish?
Yes,
are you
I am Turkish.
And what do you say about what happened in 1915? There was a lot of killing there. Was there a genocide?
It was a war. It was not a genocide. If there is something needs to be called genocide, I will ask for 90 million people died in the United States of America several hundred centuries ago. And then those are Indian peoples. I will really call that one genocide.
If the House moves ahead with this, what do you think your homeland, Turkey, will do?
The Turkey, I think they're still going to be friendly with the United States. They're going to help to each other, I think. But one thing I'm asking the United States Congress, 1980s, so many Turkish important people being killed in the United States and Canada by the terrorist group called Asala or something like that, Asala, and it was supported by the Armenian government. And I will call Armenian government is a terrorist country government.
Adamor, you're moving beyond my expertise, certainly, but we've got your point, and I thank you for your call. Let's get another on that subject from Boston. Paris, you're on the line. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Basically, the only point I wanted to make is as follows. One of our greatest allies in the world today is Germany. And they're pretty much responsible as well for one of the world's worst genocides ever. Now, I'm not condoning, of course, anything remotely close to that being an acceptable thing, but, I mean, there definitely is a way to kind of, one, recognize what has happened in the past, and two, kind of move forward from that.
But Germany doesn't walk away when the Holocaust is called a genocide. Turkey's not prepared.
You're 100% right there, and if you're asking my opinion on the topic, I mean, realistically, it would be well within Turkey's best interest to just bite the bullet, admit what happened that went wrong, and basically just kind of go from there, doing what it's done in the past. Because yeah. Realistically, it's had, as I mentioned, there is a precedent set for this to happen and still be revered as one of the world's greatest powers, as well as kind of, you know.
Yeah, we've got the point, but Germany accepted that. Turkey does not. Let's get one more from Kate in Arlington, Massachusetts. Kate, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just want to take issue with one of your callers and also with Stephen Spruill. I don't understand why denial of history needs to come into play in present politics. I think it's very important for us to bear witness to the genocide of the Armenians. Both of my grandparents' families were almost entirely killed in that. And I think calling that a war is just an embarrassment. And I don't disagree with the caller who said what happened to the American Indians was a genocide. Fine, let's label it all correctly, though. It's just, it's a denial of the past that we have a need to bear witness to.
Kate, we hear it and the testimony from your own family's experience. Stephen Spruill, how does a country like the United States weigh issues like this? On the one hand, you have history and certain moral claims. On the other hand, you have a war going on in Iraq and an ally. How does a great power put all that together?
Well, first of all, let me clarify. I feel very strongly that it was a genocide. I never said that I would call it a war. I never agreed with
that. Was
with,
our caller Adam Moore?
Our caller Adam Moore on that point. All I said was that I think it was a needless provocation. You know, there was. We should keep this issue on the table. We should address it when the time is right. I don't understand why now was the time with tensions so high between Turkey and the Kurds in their country and the Kurds in Iraq. Now we have Turkey doing military exercises on the bases. At least that's what the Kurds are reporting today. This was just unwise from a practical standpoint.
Clarence Page, do you see the real possibility here of very practical, tactical, logistical problems for the U.S. effort in Iraq? Turkey's talking about going into Iraq militarily, talking about cutting off supply lines. It seems like we've got enough trouble in Iraq already.
Right. Well, first of all, why is Nancy Pelosi and others pushing this so heavily? Because Nancy Pelosi has a really large Armenian constituency, mm-hmm. As do a number of other members of Congress. And how should President Bush play this? I think he needs to do some triangulation. He needs to play the good cop to Congress's bad cop and explain to the Turks how things work in our country. Turkey, after all, still wants to be part of NATO. They want to be part of the modern Western world, but they are a country which is a really complex country with complicated politics and ethnic historical memories, et cetera. So we have to take that into account. But President Bush, who is new to the world of diplomacy, is rapidly getting a graduate-level lesson in it.
Mm-hmm. And more boots to fall on that front. Jack?
Yes, and the president, candidate Bush, said it best in 2000. He said, quote, "The Armenians were subjected to a genocidal campaign that defies comprehension. and commands all decent people to remember and acknowledge the facts and lessons of an awful crime in a century of bloody crimes. If elected president, I would ensure that our nation properly recognizes the tragic suffering of the Armenian people. Well said, George Bush candidate. And you know, America had a role in documenting, in witnessing this. Our ambassador there, Henry Morgenthau, we were then neutral, was one of the most indefatigable witnesses to what was happening. He opened his embassy to Armenian refugees. He kept records. He helped reporters find the story. We were one of the people who brought the story out. And you know, Turkey, if it wants the world to believe that this was somehow just a war, I think historians have long since said, no, there are papers, there are documents that show intention to exterminate a people. And, you know, we don't have to keep going along with this lie. It's always going to be inconvenient to remind them. Perhaps Turkey needs to do what the Germans did and just recognize its past, a past with which, by the way, the current regime is not continuous. This, to me, is the inexplicable part of it. This Ataturk regime was the revolution against the Ottoman Empire, and yet they have kept up the torch of this myth about their past.
Yeah, advice handed down to Turkey, but Turkey's cut its hands on some important paths here, and we've got a war next door, an awkward situation. Let's go to Columbia, South Carolina. Tony is on the line. Hi, Tony. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Shifting gears back to domestic politics, I watched the Republican debate where Fred Thompson made his debut, and I thought he was very underwhelming. Seems to be the guy that was supposed to ride in on a white horse and say the Republican right, but I just don't see how he's going to win a primary, at least not even the early primaries. He's not going to win Iowa. I don't see how he can win New Hampshire. Maybe he thinks he can win here in South Carolina, but I see no groundswell of support for him here either. I just wonder how you think his candidacy is going to play out. Thanks so much.
Yeah, you bet. Tony, let me put that to the panel. Let's hear from Fred Thompson first. Here he is early on in his appearance. First question of the debate, he was asked about where he thought the economy was headed. Listen for the big halt.
This is a lot like Law and Order, Senator.
Okay, thank you.
It has a huge cast. The series seems to go on forever, and Fred Thompson shows up at the end.
And to think, I thought I was going to be the best actor on the stage.
Oh, geez, my mistake. I went straight to the laugh line there. There, of course, was the back and forth between Romney and Thompson. But let me give you that bit from Thompson early in the debate when he got into the economy.
I think there is no reason to believe that we're headed for a recession. We're enjoying 22 quarters of successive economic growth that started 2001 and then further in 2003 with the tax cuts that we put in place. We're enjoying low inflation. We're enjoying low unemployment. The stock market seems to be doing pretty well. I see no reason to believe we're headed for an economic downturn.
Well, it could happen to anybody. It could happen to me. Stephen Spruill, what did you make of Fred Thompson in the debate?
Well, you know, I thought he was wise, and that he's been wise thus far to not try to be this charismatic, you know, knight in shining armor that everybody's expecting that Tony alluded to. I think that if he did that, it's kind of a no-win situation. People would accuse him of trying to, oh, he's the actor. You know, I mean, they would say he's trying to play on that. He would come across as acting. And, you know, I thought his response to Romney's lame joke was right on. I mean, that's the knock against Romney, right, that he's fake. And Thompson essentially called him an actor. And that line was clearly Romney's line was clearly scripted. So I thought it was hilarious. I thought he did a good job.
That was maybe his high point. But what about his low-key, laid-back approach? Clarence Page, do you think it's working for Fred Thompson?
I haven't seen signs of it yet, and part of that's because of the big buildup beforehand, the heavily media-generated buildup. I'm guilty, as well as other media folks, you know, as we try, try to pump up the gate of viewers out there. But look at the polls if you want to know what his chances are. I mean, as soon as he stepped in, he was suddenly surging right up there with Giuliani. How long can he hold on to that, though? That's the challenge that he faces, and I don't see where he does have the energy, if you will, visually and audibly. As I mentioned earlier, across the board, the Republican-based support for these candidates is soft, and he's got to try to pump it up.
And Stephen Spruill, what about this Republican field across the board? Do you see something emerging here that, as a conservative, gives you hope, confidence, or not?
It's terrible, Tom. It's terrible. I won't lie. It's not impressive at all, and it's extremely divisive. It's causing debates within my movement that I think have turned incredibly silly at times, which is why, again, I have to return to Thompson and say that despite the fact that he was low-key, he wasn't a firebrand, he didn't come out charging, he didn't really pander as much as the other candidates did. I mean, out there this was a debate on economic issues, and as a conservative, I have to say Thompson was the most convincing in that he made me believe that he actually understood the free market. Now, that's with the exception of ethanol. He of course pandered on ethanol the minute he stepped into Iowa, so I think everybody expected that.
I have to say here, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Jack.
Yeah, I think we saw Republican economics in that debate. Fred Thompson said that our current prosperity is, quote, the greatest story never told. And the other candidates went on similarly about how terrific this economy is and buoyant and full of opportunity and so on. It was left to Mike Huckabee to say, I have to imagine, he says, you know, imagine the fellow at home who's lost his job because of trade and who's now facing going from a $60,000 a year job to one of $15,000, listening to you guys talking about this great economy. He's going to reach over there and turn off the dial. Well, of course, if the Republicans try to peddle this greatest story never told in the general election, a lot of people may turn off the dial on them, because economic pessimism born out of economic insecurity is strong in the society. And the second thing that came out in that debate was the free trade issue. They all were just paeans of praise to free trade. And this at a time when the Wall Street Journal, in a really remarkable poll, showed that nearly 6 in 10 Republicans feel that free trade has damaged America more than it has helped. And the third thing that came out was they all very, in one way or another, believe in supply side economics. The elixir, the tax cuts almost pay for themselves. Fred Thompson was asked, what are you going to do to take care of the alternative minimum tax? If you eliminate it, it's going to be $100 billion a year to the deficit. You say, well, that's no deficit for the people out there. They're going to be getting the money. But where is the question was about the budget. And, you know, Greg Mankiw, who was President Bush's chief of the economic advisors, he estimated that a perfectly crafted tax on capital gains, such as the one they did in 2003, matched by spending cuts, could cost over the long run, could encourage enough growth to pay for half its cost. That is to say, supply-side economics, according to the president's own former chief of council of economic advisors, is something for what he called for charlatans and cranks. And yet all of them were up there saying pretty much what charlatans and cranks say.
Stephen Spruill, I've got to ask you, just on this trade front, what about that Wall Street Journal poll? 6 in 10 Republicans expressing concern about free trade. Now, trade has created a lot of wealth in this country. It's also pinched some people. But is there something going on inside the GOP that could turn that party anti-free trade?
Well, you know, this is where I think that Jack and I just see the issue of trade differently, because I feel like he was watching another debate. I saw far too many caveats when the candidates started talking about free trade. Free trade is a good thing. It is a key contributor to the growth of our economy that we've seen over the past 22, 23 quarters. I think that they should have been much, much more aggressive and articulate in making that case, probably more articulate than I'm being now, because what that poll showed is that the Democrats have successfully framed that debate as trade costs jobs and not that trade offers us the best choice of the cheapest and best quality products from around the world.
Stephen Spruill, Clarence Page, Jack Beatty, please stand by. We're looking at a week in the news. Listeners, you can join us. 800-423-8255. How about Obama's charge that Hillary Clinton's vote on Iran could open the door to war there? Are you following the debate on domestic surveillance? 800-423-TALK is our number. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news, trouble in schools this week, and more music revolution on the internet. A black professor at Columbia University found a noose on her office door. Students protested.
Not anywhere, not here. Not anywhere, not here. Not anywhere, not here.
Another school shooting, this time in Cleveland. One student there gave his account.
By the time I got to a classroom, I had got hit with a bullet too, but I didn't realize it until I had got in the classroom.
And superstar rock band Radiohead puts a new album, In Rainbow, straight onto the web. No price tag, pay what you want. Radiohead, In Rainbows. Clarence Page joins us from the Chicago Tribune. Stephen Spruill from the National Review. Jack Beatty's here. You can join us. Why do we have another school shooting? Now Cleveland. How about those British headed down to 2,500 troops in Iraq? And our happy days here again on Wall Street. We're at 800-423-8255. Michael's calling from Potsdam, New York. Michael, you're on the air.
Well, my concern was the discussion that you had on the Nobel Peace Prize.
Yes.
I am dismayed that someone on your program would have the audacity to suggest that we consider awarding a peace prize to the sheikhs in Anbar province. These are the same people that were killing our American soldiers just several months to years ago. They are the same people that are receiving financial aid from America to actually fight the war that we are fighting. Their cooperation is being bought. Their cooperation is not altruistic.
So no thanks to a peace prize for Anbar Sheikhs. We hear that, Michael. Thank you. Let me get one more call from Bolton, Vermont. Damon, you're on the air.
Hi. My concern was something that one of the commentators said earlier about if Al Gore had won the 2000 election, we wouldn't be in a war in Iraq, and whether we should or should not be in a war in Iraq, that type of thinking I think is really irresponsible. There's no way to know how that could happen one way or the other, and to just simply flat out say that would be the case is troubling to me, and I think it cuts down the discussion that needs to be had. Also, as well, saying that this war in Iraq is the result of one man completely doesn't allow anybody else to take responsibility for what's gone on and the decisions that have been made on tons of different levels.
Damon, we hear that and we've got it. I should note, Al Gore, to Jack Beatty's earlier point, Al Gore was on the record in 2002 quite fervently opposing this war, and of course the president did push forward. Let me just take those at their face and get some more tape out here, because there's another potential conflict, Iran, spoken of on the horizon. It came up also in the Republican debate in Michigan on Tuesday, a little bit indirectly. But here's moderator and hardball host Chris Matthews pressing former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney on his constitutional views on using force. Let's listen.
If you were president of the United States, would you need to go to Congress to get authorization to take military action against Iran's nuclear facilities?
You sit down with your attorneys and tell you what you have to do, but obviously the President of the United States has to do what's in the best interest of the United States to protect us against a potential threat. The President did that as he was planning on moving into Iraq and received the authorization of Congress.
Did he need it?
You know, we're going to let the lawyers sort out what he needed to do and what he didn't need to do.
Congressman and candidate Ron Paul fired back at that suggestion by Romney that a president should consult with attorneys to see if he needed a congressional resolution to go to war.
This idea of going and talking to attorneys totally baffles me. Why don't we just open up the Constitution and read it? You're not allowed to go to war without a declaration of war. Now, as far as fleeing enemies go, yes, if there's an imminent attack on us, we've never had that happen in 220 years.
Well, Stephen Spruill, what about it? You've got Ron Paul really mixing it up in debate after debate, but what did you make of Romney saying, well, I talked to my attorneys?
Well, I think he flubbed that one big time, although there was a debate about that. I mean, obviously you would consult your lawyers. I mean, you would have to get their opinion on whether or not that was legal and how to proceed. But I was unclear on the question. I mean, what was Matthews asking? Are we talking just a strategic strike of some facilities, some suspect facilities in Iran? Because Clinton did that without asking Congress. I mean, there's precedent for that. Are we talking an invasion of Iran? I think absolutely you have to go to Congress. There's no lawyers involved there. So I think that it really depends on the context of the question. I didn't think Matthews was very clear.
Clarence Page, turn with us if you would. We heard the sound there from Columbia University. Here we've got, you know, another noose. We saw it out of Louisiana. Now there's a noose in the news from New York and Columbia releasing some images and information about that. What's going on here, Clarence?
Well, we've had nooses in the news for years. It's just they weren't making big news. We had at the University of Maryland here just after the big Jenna, Louisiana event, a noose was found in a tree near a building where black students normally meet. It wasn't clear when it was hung. It may have been there since summer and just discovered by a custodian or somebody. That didn't make big national news. I've heard of other anecdotal stories of people in workplaces or schools around the country. I mean, I have to ask, what's the big deal? If this is hung, we don't know who did it. It is a prank, as far as I'm concerned. It's something done. If it's done to intimidate, it's done by cowards, obviously, who don't even have the courage to even put some racist graffiti or something up. At Columbia, as far as I can tell from the campus newspaper and other accounts, there had been some other episodes of conflict over a cartoon in a humor publication on campus and other little things like that kind of built up, I think, to this demonstration that we saw on the streets at the campus.
But let me ask you, as an African-American observer, I mean, do you feel we're at a new bad moment in race relations, or are these outliers?
I'm too old for that, Tom. I mean, when I was a kid, we still had white and colored water fountains in the South. You know, my son, who's only just turned 18, he's the impatient one. You know, that's the way it's supposed to be. You know, he's like those kids there at Columbia, raising a great outrage over this, which to me, this is overall a sign of progress.
Let's hear from another Nobel Prize winner, a former president, Jimmy Carter, this week. Came out tough on the Bush administration. He has been before, calling it the worst in history. This week, in an interview on CNN with Wolf Blitzer, Jimmy Carter talked about the administration's decision to disregard the Geneva Convention, he says, on torture.
You believe the United States, under this administration, has used torture?
I don't think it. I know it, certainly.
So is the president lying?
The president is self-defining what we have done and authorized in the torture of prisoners, yes.
Then he went on Vice President Dick Cheney. He was asked about reported U.S. plans spurred on by Cheney to attack Iran.
As usual, Dick Cheney is wrong. He's a militant who avoided any service of his own in the military. And he has been most forceful in the last 10 years or more in fulfilling some of his more ancient commitments that the United States has a right to inject its power through military means in other parts of the world. And here he's trying again to promote what might very well be a counterproductive and a catastrophic military adventure.
Jimmy Carter, former president, there first on CNN, then on the BBC. Jack Beatty, he's got a new memoir out, but is that what's got Jimmy Carter roused to new rhetorical aggression here?
I didn't hear much rhetorical aggression. I mean, he's describing events that were even talked about in the front page of the New York Times, that relative to the Israeli strike on the Syrian, well, we don't know quite what it was. Cheney and people around him are saying, look, we can't, not only do we need to talk about confronting Iran, we have to go back and confront North Korea again. Forget about making any, stand down with them. Well, they're supplying nuclear material to Syria. And Secretary Rice was saying, well, that's unclear. We don't know what this was about. So I think when Carter says a catastrophic, or however he called it, war with Iran, that's simply a description of what would be the case. An attack on Iran would have catastrophic consequences. So I think he's just describing a real Dick Cheney is among the most dangerous people in the world, and he has the president's ear. Secretary Rice has the other ear, and we'll just have to see what happens.
Stephen Spruill, everybody got an earful from a former president right there. What do you make of that exchange?
He did. Well, we did. Well, I thought one thing was interesting that maybe hasn't been commented on. Of course, his remarks have gotten a lot of play. But one thing I found interesting was his use of the word militant to describe Dick Cheney. It just reminded me that that's a word that he uses to describe Hamas when he's asking us to recognize their right to govern Palestine, when a more appropriate word might be terrorists. So I think I'm not sure if it was an intentional equivalence there, but I found it interesting nonetheless.
They were both elected. I mean, seriously, talking about Hamas. Hamas was democratically elected. That's one nut in that argument.
Well, you could say one of them was selected.
In the case of Hamas, they were democratically elected, and that's fine. But that doesn't mean that we have to recognize them or have diplomatic relations with them if they are a terrorist organization, if they will not recognize Israel's right to exist, and if they won't renounce.
It's tough to be honest brokers if you don't. I mean, we negotiated with the North Vietnamese when they wanted when they were killing our troops. I mean, that's what negotiations are about.
There's no one to effectively negotiate with in Palestine. I mean, neither group has, Hamas is a terrorist organization, and Fatah can't fulfill any of the promises that it makes. So who do you talk to in that process?
Yeah, points made. We're going to hear a lot more about that in the month ahead as some kind of talks get geared up there again. I want to put another issue on the table, the whole S-chip health care for kids veto and the back and forth this week over 12-year-old Graham Frost. Democrats used him to respond to President Bush's veto of a bill to expand children's health care, the program. The boy said on a Democratic radio address that he and his sister had been hurt in a car crash. Since then, Republican critics have leveled charges that his family's actually well off financially. Not a sob story. Let's listen.
Even though I was hurt badly, I was really lucky. My sister and I both were. My parents work really hard and always make sure my sister and I have everything we need. But the hospital bills were huge. We got the help we needed because we had health insurance for us through the CHIP program.
Okay, Stephen Spruill, there was the boy, 12 years old, and it was kind of compelling testimony when you heard it. He's taken a lot of grief on the airwaves since then, saying, well, this isn't the right kind of family to be getting government help.
Well, there was some incorrect information out there, I think, at the outset that caused people to leap to that conclusion. But look, I think it was legitimate to ask. I think that's at the heart of the debate going on over SCHIP right now. Now it turns out that his family is perfectly eligible for SCHIP as it stands and would not need the expansion that the Democrats have proposed to qualify. Now they're proposing expanding it far beyond kids like Graham and covering, children up to 25 years old, and families with incomes that that should be able to afford their own health care. And in half the cases, and this is the Congressional Budget Office estimate, half of the newly eligible children under this proposed expansion already have private health care and would be displaced from that market. So the Democrats argue that that's okay because the important thing is that other half that get coverage, and they don't care about the displacement. Conservatives say, you know, isn't there a better way to get them coverage without creating this huge displacement in the private market?
Jack Beatty, but tough issue, and conservatives came down like a ton of bricks on Graham Frost before it all got sorted out.
Yes, they did. The myrmidons and the gargoyles of the movement, were mugging him on the blogs, notably one Michelle Malkin, who's a contributor, I guess, to the National Review and a guest on Fox. She actually went to the house and looked it over and made estimates about
his family's house, I guess.
His house. You know, when you get around to picking on kids who were, I think he was hospitalized for months in a coma because of that accident. And I really think that Paul Krugman has it right today when he said only a truly vicious political movement would respond by punishing injured children. Amen.
Clarence Page, let me ask you quickly on the surveillance front. A lot of Democrats, well, they put out some alternatives here, still an argument with President Bush, but kind of lining up to extend this government's authority to tap in on conversations in this country that may have a suspect, potentially terrorist, at the other end. What do you think Democrats are doing here?
Well, Democrats are walking that tightrope, concerned about the invasions, incursions on privacy that President Bush's strategy calls for, while at the same time not wanting to be painted as soft on terror. So we're waiting to see who blinks. But we're down to where President Bush is arguing against in favor of protections for corporations like telecommunications companies that cooperate with the National Security Agency in the conducting wiretaps. That's the sort of thing that it does raise very serious issues. I suspect the Democrats are probably going to blink this being an election year. We will see.
Let's get one more call for you, Clarence, from Lou in Buffalo, New York. Lou, you're on the air.
Clarence, thank you for taking my call. Clarence, I've been a Chicago Cubs fan since the days of Ken Hubbs, the promising rookie who got killed in a plane crash in 1962. And my question for you,
I share your suffering.
Yeah, in the 99th year of rebuilding, what happened to "it's going to happen"? Sir, please answer that for me, please.
A Cubs fan wants a mercy, Clarence Page. Is this the year? You know, in Red Sox country, we don't know about that.
Yeah, well, I sympathize with the Red Sox because we share such similar history. I suspect we're going to have to wait until next year once again for our Cubbies.
Oh,
question
boy.
Is, who will own them?
Yeah. There's a major league question all over the ballpark. It's been a great hour. I want to thank each of you for being with us. Clarence Page with the Chicago Tribune, thank you so much for joining us today.
And thank you.
Stephen Spruill with the National Review and National Review Online. Thanks for being here, Stephen.
Thanks, Tom. My pleasure.
Jack Beatty, great to have you as always.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. On Point is produced by Chris Burrell, Julie Jopp, Eileen Imada, Stefano Katsonis, Hillary McQuilkin, Tanya Raleigh, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and John Wibby, with help from Allison Bagg and Noah Hertz-Bunzel. Our senior producer is Wen Stevenson. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.